Case number 12-7114, Vanessa Coleman, appellant versus District of Columbia et al. Ms. Randall for the appellant, Mr. Schifferle for the appellees.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Jasonique Randall, and on behalf of Howard University Clinical Law Center, I represent Ms. Vanessa Coleman, the appellant in this case. Your Honors, this is a case about a high-ranking 17-year veteran of the D.C. Fire Department who stuck her neck out to expose the department's wrongdoings and disregard for the safety of the firefighters and the public in wake of one of the largest fires in recent D.C. history. As a result of Ms. Coleman's disclosures, she was stripped of her rank as one of the highest-ranking African-American women in the department. She was demoted to menial tasks such as counting and cataloging chairs, and she was forced to undergo a mental evaluation. Your Honors, we respectfully ask this court, to reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment for the following three reasons. One, Ms. Coleman's disclosures satisfy the reasonable belief test and that it was reasonable for her, as captain in the fire department with an exemplary record, to believe that her disclosures exposed misconduct and were thus protected. Two, the district court misapplied the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting standard by placing the entire burden of proof on Ms. Coleman. And three, Ms. Coleman presented sufficient evidence to permit a reasonable fact finder to conclude that the possible reasoning given by the fire department was pretext. Your Honors, in arguing that Ms. Coleman's disclosures were not protected, the fire department relied on three cases.
To do a protected disclosure, you have to disclose something in the sense that the person hearing the information didn't already know that information. It had to be unknown to them. Otherwise, you're not disclosing anything they didn't already know. What evidence in the record was there that, with respect to her disclosures about the fire, that the folks didn't already know everything that she was talking about and disclosing?
Yes, Your Honor, it was found that the cause of the fire was a miscommunication in which the basement was not checked. In Ms. Coleman's disclosure, she disclosed that the reason that the basement was not checked was because of the breakdown in communication during the fire. Also, following that fire, the department settled on an informal investigation instead of conducting a formal, thorough investigation where all of the parties were involved. On June 9, 2008, Ms. Coleman wrote a memo to her supervisors expressing her concerns with the informal evaluation, stating, "I'd like to bring attention to the facts that the integrity of the hearing was compromised."
But that's not anything that they wouldn't have already known. I mean, it has to be a disclosure of something new, some new information that for example, Chief Rubin didn't already know about. Presumably the chief knew that there had been chosen to do an informal rather than formal investigation and knew about this debate about who had said what to whom and communicated what to whom about checking the basement during the fire. So how is it protected in that sense?
Ms. Coleman's disclosures, taken individually and as a whole, what she was trying to disclose is that there were deeper systematic failures within the fire department that went beyond just one instance of miscommunication on the fire ground. As discussed in our briefs, Ms. Coleman also spoke about how she would have radio transmissions that wouldn't be acknowledged. She would have to send several radio transmissions before she can get an acknowledgement. Also, she spoke about how when she would try to submit disciplinary reports for her subordinates, her superiors.
Those were separate letters from these letters complaining about what happened at the fire. So are you conceding that these letters where she was talking about what happened at the fire were not protected disclosures because they weren't disclosing new information?
We are saying that they were protected because she was trying to disclose the deeper systematic failures within the
right,
system.
But the things you just listed as systematic failures, them not acting on complaints against her or her radio transmissions, were not the systematic failures attributable to the Mount Pleasant fire. Am I correct on that?
We're saying that they are contributed to what happened at the fire because there is a breakdown in communication that was not just happening at that one incident at the fire ground, but it was happening as throughout the fire department.
But they found, I mean, there was a finding at this proceeding before Chief Rubin that the breakdown was that both she and Lee were responsible in different ways. He should have followed up with her, and she should have alerted him that she hadn't been able to do the basement check. Nothing to do with radio transmissions not being answered.
What we're saying is that her disclosures go not just to what happened at that instance at the fire ground, but what happened at the fire ground and in the aftermath of that fire. Aside from...
With respect to the facts about the fire, about who was responsible for checking the basement or how they allocated responsibility for that failure, could she have appealed the decision of Chief Rubin and challenged those facts?
Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure about the appeals process within the fire department. I would be happy to submit a supplemental brief for that. But the moment that the fire department began retaliating against Ms. Coleman for her disclosures, that was when it was Ms. Coleman felt that it was deserving of the DCWPA.
I'm just trying to determine, do we take the facts as found by Chief Rubin at the hearing with respect to what happened in the Mount Pleasant fire, because she didn't challenge or appeal those? Do we have to accept those facts as true? Because she has obviously a different version of those facts.
Your Honor, what I would say is that we can accept those facts as true, but Ms. Coleman's disclosures speak beyond just gross mismanagement, but also speak to a threat to public safety and a violation of law when they forced her to undergo a mental evaluation against the DCWPA's prohibition to referrals for psychological counseling.
Do you know what the general standard is for referring someone for a psychological evaluation?
When you have a belief that the person is unfit for duty.
When their supervisor has just any belief the person might be unfit in any way for duty, they can send them off for a psychological examination?
There has to be a reasonable belief.
Okay. Is that in a regulation or something somewhere? Or how do we know what the test is, the ordinarily applied? Because we can't know if we can't really evaluate this decision to send her for a psychological evaluation unless we know what the normal rule is applied across the board to sending people off for psychological evaluations.
I do not have any citations for what is generally the standards. I do know that in the City of Miami case that the fire department cited, in that case, the police department felt that it was a need for their employees to undergo a psychological evaluation because he was paranoid about his health issues disclosures being revealed. He felt like they were after him, attacking him. However, the reason why that they asked for him to disclose his health issues was because there were, as his job as police officers, there were high-risk individuals that they were in contact with. In this case is different because Ms. Coleman Ms. Coleman was disciplined for following her superior's orders at the fire ground and later subsequently disciplined for not quietly accepting her discipline and for disclosing what the fire department's systematic failures were.
On the 24-hour suspension, did you argue at summary judgment anywhere that the 24-hour suspension was a retaliatory measure?
Yes, Your Honor, we do argue that the 24-hour suspension was a retaliatory.
Did you argue that at summary judgment?
I'm not exactly sure if that is in our response to our motion for summary judgment. However, that is one of the issues that the fire department raised we waived some of the issues because we did not respond to them in motion for summary judgment. However, we are saying that we are not bringing any new claims here. Her claim has been consistent that she has been retaliated against under the DCWPA prohibition against retaliation for exposing the gross mismanagement, violations of
law. And on the 24-hour suspension, what evidence do you have that Chief Kane was aware that she had engaged in any protected disclosures?
At this time, Your Honor, I do not have the answer to that. Secondly, Your Honor.
You started off earlier saying that the district court had misapplied the McDonnell-Douglas framework.
Yes.
My question is, does that even apply here?
Yes. Under the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting standard, what the district court implied a legitimate reasoning in the absence of the fire department actually providing a reasoning. Under the McDonnell-Douglas, the employers only have to provide a legitimate reasoning as to why they retaliated against here. What the fire department has done and what the district court has permitted it to do is to imply a number of reasons without ever committing to a single one. We don't know if she was retaliated against because she did not quietly accept her memos, because of the amount or the language within her memos. If we don't know if she was retaliated against because they deemed her to be unbalanced. What the department has done and what the district court has allowed it to do is unfairly prejudice Ms. Coleman by denying her a full and fair opportunity of rebuttal. In Franco Construction, the Supreme Court has noted that in the absence of an employer providing a legitimate reasoning, it is more proper than not for them to infer an illegitimate reasoning. Here, the district court did just the opposite and inferred a legitimate reasoning on behalf of the fire department. Also, even if the fire department had met its burden in providing a legitimate reasoning for their adverse actions, Ms. Coleman has presented sufficient evidence to show that that reasoning would be pretext. Aside from the temporal proximity between Ms. Coleman's disclosures and her punishment, one of the possible justifications that the fire department gave was that she was fired because of the failure of her to check the basement. However, on page 8 of our brief, it says that the fire department expresses itself as a paramilitary organization with a hierarchical structure that requires obedience from subordinates to their superiors. Here, Ms. Coleman did exactly what she was commanded to do by her superiors. Therefore, a reasonable trier of fact could find that that reason is pretext. Also, Ms. Coleman spent over 17 years successfully rising through the ranks from cadet to captain before Ms. Coleman began to be considered as an unbalanced woman. Our question to the fire department is, why is it after her 17 years successfully as a veteran who has an exemplary record, why is it that the moment she began speaking out against the fire department's wrongdoing that she was punished and demoted and labeled as an unbalanced woman? Your Honors, I see that I'm over my time. Can I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Carl Schifferle for the District of Columbia. The District Court did not err in granting summary judgment to the District on Ms. Coleman's whistleblower claims. For each adverse action that she's claiming now on appeal, she failed to show a protected disclosure or, alternatively, a causal connection between any protected disclosure and any personnel action.
Can you ask counsel? I want to go back to where we ended with Ms. Randall, and that is the whole question of the application of the McDonnell-Douglas framework here, because even the court admits that at least as to that first, perhaps protected disclosure, there is no independent reason offered by the fire department.
I'm sorry, the district court, did you say?
Right. In other words, looking at whether or not there, you know, she had made this initial showing, and then the court admits that in their motion for summary judgment, the government doesn't specify what those independent reasons were, although they can be inferred.
Okay. Well, I disagree with sort of the way that the district court decision might be characterized. And in our view, And the district court said that it was simply assuming that Ms. Coleman could make that sort of prima facie showing, which is sufficient evidence to establish a causal connection. But then the district court did analyze the evidence and the record in the case, and that included the reason for the personnel actions, including the discipline for the Mount Pleasant fire. And those reasons were evident and abundant in the record, that on the face of it, she was disciplined for failing to check the basement and or for failing to notify her superior that she was unable to complete that order to check the basement. So that was apparent from the record. Ms. Coleman had notice of that all along. It was the reason the discipline was imposed. She had a hearing. She had a written decision and a preceding notice, all spelling that out.
I don't know how you, the district court assumed that with respect to several of these charges, internal communications, legal and administrative filings, and external statements, the district court did not find that those were protected. It said, I don't have to, I'm going to go to the next step. But she put in an expert testimony which put these things in context. And I don't know how you can prevail on summary judgment unless you find all of these things were unprotected. And the district court did not find that all of the categories that she's complaining about were unprotected. As I recall, the district court just moved on and said, maybe so, maybe not, or I'll assume they are, or they...
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the district court did specifically find that most were unprotected.
But there's some that the district court did not make that finding. Those are the ones I'm talking about.
Okay. Well, then Ms. Coleman on appeal has not identified those that were found to be protected and then tied them to a specific personnel action that she contends is retaliatory. She hasn't done that in her briefs on appeal.
Well, I think she very much has. I mean, she had a letter at the end of June where she said, I'm being sent off for this fitness for duty exam because I've been whistleblowing and I've been making complaints about what's going on in this department. Now, that is asserting a protective disclosure and connecting it to a specific action.
I don't recall that being specifically relied upon in the briefs, but assuming so, a reference to the order to undergo the fitness for duty evaluation being retaliatory, obviously it couldn't have caused both the discipline initially for the Mount Pleasant fire and couldn't have been the cause of the order to undergo the evaluation.
The whole rationale given by the district court, and as I saw in your briefs, is she's sure been complaining a lot, and we don't like particular word choices. She must be erratic and crazy. Let's get her examined. Now, that seems to me, you in your own words, saying the very reason we're sending her for this examination is she's logging in a bunch of complaints.
Right.
At least
right.
The complaint that I'm being... There were two things. One, there was a long letter on June 23rd, I think, about all the things that structurally she thought had gone wrong at this fire. And then her assertion that you said that just 2 days later, she got sent off for this exam. And your explanation and the district court's explanation, the reason she got sent for the exam, was she'd been complaining.
Right. But first of all, those complaints do not rise to the level of protected disclosure or gross mismanagement. She fails to identify or explain how they fit in any of the categories. But even assuming that they were protected disclosures, she still has to show causation. And there's no dispute that the reason why, there's no genuine dispute that the reason why she was referred included written statements, but the language in there, she used the words conspiracy, mutiny, concealed acts of friendly fire, combat.
Here's where I think we got a real problem, all right, because you say there's no dispute. Well, they very much dispute, and she in fact had an expert witness who looked at those exact same emails and letters and said, occasionally there's a word here or there, but when you look at them, and I'm happy to look at them with you right now, when you look at them in context, this expert said there's nothing here that warrants an examination, and it is simply cherry-picking particular words out of multi-page documents that are otherwise completely substantive.
Right.
And given that she'd been working for 17 years, I'm not saying which way is true or not, but a jury could certainly look at that and say, you're grasping at straws here. picking one word out at a time.
Respectfully, no. Yeah,
but you got to focus on the district court found that or said or assumed that certain of these activities were protected and then went on to analyze. And those included internal communications regarding race and sex discrimination, legal and administrative findings including the EEOC and Office of Human Rights, and external statements regarding race and sex discrimination. Mm-hmm. The district court assumed that those were protected. Now, I don't know how you get summary judgment if you assume they're protected, and she has contested vigorously with the points that my colleague has just read, in particular the expert testimony said there's no conceivable way that they could have proceeded the way they proceeded.
Your Honor, respectfully, even assuming a protected disclosure, and I'll assume that at this point of the argument.
That's what the district court did. That's what's here on appeal.
Then that's fine. Then we still get to the issue of causation.
Right.
And the test, respectfully, Judge Millett, is not whether an expert a year later can come in and second-guess whether an evaluation was required. But as this court explained in its recent decision in McCormick, that sort of second-guessing is not the test for whether a plaintiff can establish evidence of causation.
Wait. McCormick was a very different setting. In this context, surely McCormick didn't hold that if she says, I made all these complaints and disclosures, which we're assuming were protected, and then you said, because I've made what you deem to be too many disclosures, and you don't like some of the word choice, you're sending me off for a fitness examination, and I come back with an expert who says this is no basis for a fitness examination, that we can't decide. That's exactly what we have to decide is whether that's a jury question. That's not, McCormick didn't say anything like that.
Well, I do think, as McCormick said, as long as there is a basis for the decision, even if it's wrong, even if the employer was wrong, that doesn't matter. That doesn't get you to a jury. It's whether the employer had a basis. And I believe that those statements to
if she comes forward with evidence that it's pretextual, then what happens? She's saying that wasn't the basis. You didn't have a basis. I have evidence that it was pretextual. Again, not for us to decide one way or the other. The question is, does she go to a jury?
Well, no, because, first of all, she doesn't dispute the word choices that she used, that she was facing execution. She talked about a pursuit to diabolically cripple my career has become the primary agenda of my chief official. She said a swift action will not taken. The entire agency will lie in irreversible peril. Plus, there is the volume of these communications, 6 memos to the fire chief in a single day, which even she admitted was out of the ordinary.
No, Assistant but stop. Chief, just please stop there. Okay. All right? Someone does 6 disclosures, which we're assuming are protected, and maybe it's out of the ordinary. Now, it could be out of the ordinary because there's a problem, or it could be out of the ordinary because there's a problem in the fire department. I can't imagine how we can, in one breath, say that it's because of the disclosures she's getting sent off for the fitness exam, and then say that those disclosures were not the cause for the referral for the fitness exam. It seems to be a dangerous proposition.
Right. It's not what is protected in the communications that is what is causing the referral to the examination. It is the specific language that is being used.
Tell me the specific language test when we're deciding whether something should go to the jury. Is it if you can pick out particular words that you find objectionable, even if the other content of the memo is not objected to or complained about, that's enough? I don't understand how your find a few words in each memo test works.
Well, because that defeats the plaintiff's ability to show causation, because she does not deny that those words were used. And a supervisor has a basis.
But she denies, as a matter of fact, that those things were a basis for inferring erratic behavior, and she has an expert witness who spent years and years and years evaluating people in the police and fire department that says this is this language and these complaints are in no basis whatsoever for referral. Why isn't that a fact dispute?
Well, because that is the type of second-guessing that this court has held cannot apply. Assistant Fire Chief Lee, who made the decision to refer, actually met with her in person on several occasions and actually interacted with her. So it's his decision, not some expert a year later who was not involved.
No.
And whether he had a basis. And if I may add, Your Honor, there's also the demeanor she presented to him. He testified that in his conversations with her, she was frantic. Her statements were disjointed. She was even a little incoherent. There were issues.
Did you argue an appeal that pursuant to our de novo review standard, we should reject the district court's suggestion that the categories we're talking about now were protected?
No, Your Honor.
Does your argument include that the district court was simply wrong in even suggesting that these were protected activities? Because then all of what we're talking about now is moot. I mean,
well, respectfully, no. I agree that we're not contesting certain things that the district court found were protected. But the plaintiff has not then taken that, identified which protected disclosure is causally connected to a specific action. But even then, right, we can assume that there were protected disclosures. Still has to be that causal connection, which is what we've been...
I just want to confirm, you have not put that in contest on appeal, because you could say, Your Honor, it's a summary judgment. You can look at this de novo. District court's assumption is wrong. You're looking at the same materials the district court looked at. District court was wrong. None of this is protected activity.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll indulge the rest of the conversation if you want us to, but that's not the way you're arguing the case.
Okay. No, but we do say that whatever protected disclosure has been forfeited because the plaintiff has not tied it to a specific adverse action. There's no analysis, no discussion in the briefs of how any of these protected disclosures relate to a specific adverse action. I would also mention, too, the importance of these fitness for duty evaluations. We cited the Kaufman case in our brief, for example. There, the court specifically refused to second-guess the decision of fire department officials to require a firefighter to undergo a fitness for duty
evaluation.
What
is the standard? What is the standard that's applied in deciding whether somebody who's been working for 17 years suddenly needs a fitness for duty exam? There must be some objective standard for applying these things, or no? Is it just...
Well, the regulations, and we did cite to it 6 DCMR 2049, although not directly applicable to the fire department, because it does mention that where inconsistent, these regulations don't apply to the fire department, but it does refer to there being a direct question of the employee's fitness for duty. And we would argue that all of those statements, certainly when an employee is talking about a conspiracy, a mutiny, that everyone is out to destroy her, all the various written statements, the volume of them, the demeanor that she presents, the decreasing work performance, she had multiple EEO complaints against her, she was refusing to cooperate and participate in EEO training. And these are all based on the perspective of Assistant Fire Chief Lee, who is ordering the evaluation. So it's his decision. And the question is whether he had a basis in light of all of that, not whether he was right or wrong, but whether he had a basis to do so. And we believe McCormick stands for that. And the other cases from this court.
Now, McCormick involved facts found after an internal affairs investigation. And then we said we're not going to be the second round of an internal affairs investigation. But this decision to refer for fitness for duty was not the product of an internal affairs investigation, was it?
No, but it was the result of a similar arriving at a conclusion based on the facts in front of
But I think every employer action that gets challenged as discriminatory or retaliatory for whistleblowing is going to be the product of an employer action based on information. That's what every employer is going to say that.
Right.
I'm concerned you're reading McCormick is writing all these statutory protections right off the books.
Right, but it is the plaintiff's burden to establish all the elements, and that includes causation. If she's going to establish causation through showing pretext, then she can't just say that a jury might have decided differently whether a fitness for duty evaluation was warranted. She has to show that there was no basis, or as this court also said in Fishbach, that the employer made a mistake that was too obvious to be unintentional. So under that standard, the plaintiff has not shown pretext, cannot establish causation, and therefore the entry of summary judgment was proper.
Can I just have one quick question? On the when they had the hearing on the Mount Pleasant fire and she had the 24-hour suspension, was there any procedural route by which she could have appealed that decision?
Yes, Your Honor. On appendix page 195, which is Chief Rubin's decision affirming the decision of Battalion Fire Chief Kane to impose a 24-hour suspension, it does say on that page that she has the right to appeal to the Office of Compliance. And as far as the record shows, she did not pursue that appeal. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Ms. Rendell, you had no time left. The court will give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. Your Honors, the correct inquiry is, would Ms. Coleman have been retaliated against but for her disclosures? What the fire department has done is focused on the language and the amount of memos that Ms. Coleman has submitted, but they have not shown what it was in those memos that would have translated into her not being able to do well on her job. On section 1-615.52 and the DCWPA, it says that a protective disclosure is any disclosure not prohibited by statute without restriction to time, place, form, motive, or context that evidences gross mismanagement, violation of law, and danger to public safety. Your Honors, this is a motion for summary judgment in which the district court resolved every single inference in favor of the fire department as the moving party.
Tell me where you have argued to us with respect to the three matters that the district court assumed were protected activity. Where you've argued to us and made the connections and causality and pretext, and that is in internal communications regarding race and sex, legal and administrative findings, and external statements regarding race and sex. District court assumed that that's protected activity. But where are you isolating those matters and saying, here's how we're playing out each one in this case?
Your Honors, I don't believe that we've isolated each individual incident, but I believe...
No, I mean those categories. Those are three categories the district court assumed were protected.
Yes.
The other side is saying, with some force, well, you haven't done anything with it. You haven't shown the court. So show me the causality and show me the pretext and what is your argument with respect to those three categories. Because if you have anything that's in my view, it's with respect to these three things, but I'm not sure what your argument is.
Our argument is that it is too close to be a coincidence that the moment that this firefighter began, this 17-year veteran with an exemplary record, began speaking out against the fire department.
No, you got to focus, I'm sorry. Okay. But you have to focus more specifically on the internal communications regarding race and sex, the legal and administrative filings, and the external statement. Those are the categories the district court is giving to you as a starting point.
Yes. As regards to the EEO complaints, I would have to submit a supplemental brief for that, Your Honor. Okay. In resolving the fact that the court implied a legitimate reasoning where the department offered none is the most obvious reason, is the most obvious example of where the court's error on this motion for summary judgment as an inference in favor of the fire department as the moving party, but it's not the only one. In regards to whether the department had a legitimate reasoning as opposed to their reasoning being pretext, the court resolved that dispute in favor of the department. In resolving the disputed question of whether or not Ms. Coleman's disclosures were a threat to public safety instead of inter-office disputes, the court resolved that dispute in the department's favor. Your Honors, for those foregoing reasons, we ask that this court overturn the district court's grant of motion for summary judgment. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.